Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world, and happy Friday, everybody. Today is July 3rd, 2026. Happy birthday, America. 250 years, and you don't even look a day over 240. As you guys may already know, the market is closed today for the 4th of July weekend, but we're going to do a show anyway because there's a lot going on in the world, and you know what? It's a free country, so why the heck not? Big story this morning broke late yesterday afternoon. Blackstone is pulling out of a massive data center project in Prince William County, Virginia. Blackstone is now the second major asset manager to pull out of this massive project. You may recall we covered earlier last month that Brookfield had pulled out of this project. This is a $100 billion data center. It's twice the size of Central Park, uses probably about as much power as New York City. This project has been falling apart for a couple of months now. Local opposition was very strong to this project. It's built adjacent to a Civil War battlefield that used to be protected land. They're saying in this article in Bloomberg that will show you that there was a clerical blunder that resulted in lawsuits. It wasn't a clerical blunder. The local zoning commission deliberately jammed this into a meeting at the last minute in violation of public disclosure rules in order to avoid a big turnout at the meeting when they jammed it through in the middle of the night. Then that zoning board got voted out because of that, and a guy who ran on just canceling this data center project got voted in. Now the project is effectively dead. And look, guys, this is we heard yesterday during the read-off of all of the disclosures in Oracle's annual report about all the risks to these data center investments and local opposition and zoning problems and environmental restrictions was one of the many, many things that Oracle had listed as risks to this data center build-out. And this massive project right in the middle of Data Center Alley in Northern Virginia is falling victim to one of those. Now, as all of this is going on, we had Mark Zuckerberg held a virtual town hall at Meta yesterday where he admitted a couple of things. And Meta has been in the news quite a bit over these last couple of days. First of all, he said that AI agents had not progressed as expected. I guess the company was hoping to achieve some big productivity booms from these AI agents. And shocking, this just in. Yeah, AI has not lived up to the hype. I know, I'm as shocked as you guys are. They also said that the job cuts at Meta didn't go as clean as possible. Yeah, we fired thousands of people and then took thousands of other people and said, instead of, you know, a highly respected engineer right now, you're basically a data labeler, and we're going to record everything you do on your computer and use it to train the AI agents that are going to replace you, those same agents that are now not progressing as fast as possible. The culture at Meta, the morale among their employees is said to be at historic lows here. And keep in mind, all of this is happening just 2 days after Meta announced that they're getting into the NeoCloud business. So I've still got a couple of questions. For example, Meta has promised to rent $35 billion worth of computing capacity from CoreWeave over the next few years. So now that Meta is a competitor of CoreWeave, are they going to continue to be a customer of CoreWeave? Are they going to keep renting from CoreWeave? What, just to turn around and sublet that same compute, probably at a lower price? Or maybe Meta's about to cancel some of those investments in CoreWeave or some of those very loosely worded non-binding memorandums of understanding that they signed with the NeoCloud. Just maybe that story is about to go away. And what about that CapEx? I have to wonder if Meta has just tacitly admitted that they overbuilt and that they're not seeing any return on productivity, as he just said, the thing with the AI agents, how do they justify continuing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars every year on this big CapEx build out? And look, the first hyperscaler to announce that they're cutting back their CapEx, this bubble goes kablooey. That will be the beginning of the end for the AI bubble. And if you had asked me 2 weeks ago, who will be dead last among the hyperscalers to cut their CapEx, I would have said Meta. Facebook will be the last one. After all the money they blew on the metaverse, what a joke, they renamed the whole company after that. After all that, I would have figured Meta would be the last one to ever admit that they overspent and cancel some of that CapEx. But right now, after the story about becoming a NeoCloud, I would say Meta has now jumped out in front. You know, a few weeks ago, I would have said Microsoft is probably going to be first to cut their CapEx. Now I'm not so sure. Could be Microsoft, it could be Meta, or Amazon, or Oracle, or any of the other ones. Whoever does it, they're in this great game of CapEx chicken. They all need to keep lighting their money on fire in this big contest to keep their stocks elevated. And whoever comes to their senses first loses. Now, as that is going on, we had a story about Anthropic is developing a custom new chip with Samsung. What's it going to do? They don't know. Nobody knows. They're making a chip that will do a thing, but nobody knows what that's going to be. They haven't made up their mind yet. But one thing it will do is pump South Korean stocks. The KOSPI index rallied by 6% yesterday on that news. The volatility in South Korea continues to be wild day in and day out. And again, guys, volatility is a sign of a top. Meanwhile, we've had Tesla took a big hit yesterday. That stock was down 7.5%. After they reported what seemed like good news. I mean, ostensibly, this was a great report about vehicle deliveries and production, all way ahead of forecast, as Tesla is known to do. But Tesla sold off on that news. They've done this in the past. They report great delivery numbers, and then they sell off. Also, very interesting in this Tesla story, buried way down at the bottom of the article, Tesla talked about how they sold $269 million of power packs. That's the battery packs that they make that typically go along with their solar panels. But the customer that bought those $269 million of power packs, you might find that interesting. This mystery customer who also bought a lot of Cybertrucks last year. You may guess who we're talking about here. You'll never in a million years guess who's buying all of Elon Musk's product. Let's see. Also, shifting gears a little bit over to the Middle East, the Kurds have entered the chat, apparently. It is Friday. We have our wars on Friday, and then we have our peace on Sunday night. So this is maybe a leading candidate for what starts the shooting over this long holiday weekend, again, as we're prone to do. But there were some attacks in northwestern Iran that were led by Kurdish rebel groups who have been noticeably absent from this conflict since it began at the beginning of March. You may recall a lot of the U.S. strategy hinged upon local opposition in Iran rising up to overthrow the Iranian regime. And that did not happen. President Trump even went on TV and said, we tried to get weapons to these Iranian opposition groups using the Kurds as couriers, but the Kurds took all the weapons for themselves. Now, that was never confirmed, but that's just a thing Trump said. Of course, that's a big asterisk. We always put a big asterisk next to things Trump says. But now the Kurds apparently are getting froggy. There were some ambushes on IRGC positions. A couple of IRGC people were killed. Then there were stories yesterday about heavy armor and artillery on the Iranian side moving into the region. There have been counterattacks. Several Kurdish have been killed. Now, I don't know if this means you've got all-out civil war developing in Iran or not. I think this is pretty small relative to, you know, on a national scale. But it does beg the question, if the Kurds, who have historically been our allies against ISIS and in Iraq, if they are now rising up against Iran, do we come to their aid? Do we violate the ceasefire, the memorandum of understanding, which most people will admit is largely a joke anyway? Or do we just leave them to fend for themselves? Another case of Iran, of America not backing their allies. I don't know. We have a choice between several bad options here. Also, commercial real estate back in the news as well. S2 Capital, a $400 million multifamily commercial real estate fund, is shutting down operations, and I quote, with no return of capital. Shout out to my friend, the Pasta Man, and Frank Nightingale, who sent this one out on X yesterday, this story in The Real Deal. No return of capital, which means, let me translate that. If you were invested in this fund, you lost all your money. Somebody maybe asked, is negative 100%, is that a lot? Is that a good investment performance? But you can trot out the usual suspects who say the worst is behind us in commercial real estate, and don't worry, the Fed is going to cut rates and ride to the rescue. I've been hearing that for about 6 years now. We've got Blue Owl redemptions again in the news. Great news, though. The requests for redemptions at Blue Owl were slightly better than absolutely catastrophic. And that is good news for Blue Owl. Not quite as bad as they were last quarter. But remember, last quarter, they were just terrible, absolutely catastrophic. But the private credit industry as a whole has gone from bad to worse. We got this article in the Wall Street Journal this morning that talks about, on the whole, we have had more requests for withdrawals in the private credit industry and less money returned to those investors. So both of those trends going in the wrong direction, spreading further apart. The problems in private credit are definitely not behind us. The worst is yet to come. Guys, we got a lot to talk about despite this holiday with markets closed. So why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance as I drop my pen. Don't worry, I got a backup right here. Nukes always have a contingency plan. Hey, don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the algorithm so you can come back and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day and occasionally on business holidays, as we're doing right now to celebrate America's birthday. And again, markets are closed, so we'll skip right past the indexes this morning, going right over to the commodities board. It is a good day for the shinies. Spot gold is higher by $44, or 1.07% higher at $4,168 an ounce. Spot silver has had a good couple of days here, another $1.07 higher, just above 62 cents an ounce for spot silver, or 1.7% in the green. I like the shiny. Copper is higher by 0.75%. Platinum is higher by 1.7%. Palladium is higher by 0.5%. All the metals are in the green this morning. Crude oil down another 12 cents here, 68.57, or 0.17%. We'll have some, we'll talk about oil a little bit later in the show here. And we've also got the US dollar is pretty much unchanged here, 100.82, little bit weaker, down about 0.4%. Just going to check in over with the Japanese yen, because that was getting awful froggy yesterday. There was rumors of yen intervention, or at least a rate check or some involvement of Japanese finance authorities yesterday with the yen, which is why we had that big red candle yesterday, which is a sudden strengthening of the yen, pretty much unchanged from those levels here at 161.23. The market remains on edge, waiting for Japanese authorities to intervene. Looking over at Bitcoin, we're at $61,984. That's higher by about $500. Bitcoin is now up 3 days in a row, well off of its lows of about 57,000 that were hit earlier this week. And I got to send a shout out to my friend Ed Zitron on X, who was on CNBC yesterday. And congratulations to Ed Zitron, by the way. He has been on Bloomberg recently. He's been on CNBC. Finally, Ed Zitron has got the financial press to cover the bear case for the AI bubble. And I shared this yesterday on my Twitter feed. I encourage everybody to go watch this segment. Ed did an excellent job articulating the bear case for the biggest investment fraud and speculative asset bubble in history. But during that clip, it was this particular screen that you're looking at right now when they flashed this on the screen, OpenAI's financials for 2025. And guys, this happens at about 42 seconds into the video. And just look at those numbers. Stop and take that in for a minute. $13 billion in revenue for OpenAI and $38.5 billion of net losses. That means OpenAI is spending $4 to make $1. That's what that means. For every $4 they spend, they get $1 in revenue. That's not getting better. These numbers are getting worse. Every quarter, every year, for the last 3.5 years, the losses have gotten bigger, while we're told, don't worry, just a few days away from AGI or artificial general intelligence, Skynet, whatever, the cure cancer, all the crap that they promise us, and we're going to make all this money and we're going to create all these productivity gains. None of that has come into fruition while the losses continue to get bigger every freaking day. Ed did an excellent job with that. Highly recommend you check that one out. But here's the big story this morning. Blackstone's QTS abandons massive data center in Virginia. They are the second company to do so. Blackstone's QTS is walking away from plans to build its portion of a 2,100-acre data center campus in Virginia, handing a win to residents who fought for years to topple the project. The data center developer had planned to transform more than 800 acres in Northern Virginia's Prince William County into a centerpiece of one of the world's largest technology corridors. Located at the edge of a historic Civil War battlefield and on what used to be land protected from development, the Digital Gateway project ignited strong pushback from homeowners and has been stalled by lawsuits. In recent days, QTS executives decided that it isn't worth pressing forward in court, according to people familiar with the matter, who asked not to be named. After careful consideration, QTS has made the decision to terminate the Digital Gateway project. Attorneys representing the firm said in a court filing, confirming an earlier Bloomberg report, the company will now work on a responsible and orderly wind down of development efforts. QTS rapid growth had made the company a poster child of how private equity has fueled the data center industry's breakneck expansion. Those ambitions are colliding with public anxiety over strains to electricity grids and home prices from AI data centers. The retreat deals a blow to a landmark mega site roughly twice the size of New York Central Park with city-sized power needs. The initiative was supposed to bring in some $100 billion in spending and create one of the world's largest technology corridors. The project had sparked contentious, drawn-out public hearings. A clerical blunder related to public notices for a key zoning meeting created setbacks for developers. By the way, that is complete horse manure from Bloomberg, and they know it. It wasn't a clerical blunder. They intentionally violated the requirements for public disclosure and advance notice that they were going to vote on a project of this size. They're supposed to put them out days in advance so the public has a chance to show up at the meeting and be heard. They didn't do that. They crammed this in the middle of the night in a special meeting and approved it, knowing that it would be wildly unpopular with the locals who were opposed to the project. And everyone on that board who did that lost their jobs and got replaced by people who were opposed to the data center. That was not a clerical blunder. That was a blatant violation of the law. Already, Brookfield backed Compass Data Centers, which was supposed to build on more than 800 acres at that same site, had pulled out in May. So first Brookfield pulled out, now Blackstone has pulled out. The U-turns by both firms amount to one of the most dramatic retreats by developers from a data center project. It's a reminder of how tech firms race for the computing infrastructure to support AI advances is increasingly facing bottlenecks from power shortages to supply crunches. Organized opposition is mounting, forcing firms and developers to be more deliberate about where they choose to build. So this project, it's pretty much dead here now. You've got two of the biggest financial backers have canceled their portions. Meanwhile, we got more bad news for the AI bubble. In an exclusive on Reuters, Meta's Zuckerberg says AI agent tech is progressing slower than expected. Maybe that has something to do with Meta's recent decision to rent out their excess computing capacity. And again, I'm yet to hear anybody explain how we could have excess computing capacity and be compute constrained and the demand is insatiable all at the same time. It's almost like one of these two is lying. Meta's CEO Mark Zuckerberg acknowledged shortcomings in the company's sweeping restructuring at an internal town hall on Thursday, saying the systems known as AI agents had not progressed as quickly as he had expected, according to a recording heard by Reuters. Zuckerberg added that a company reorganization that included major job cuts was not as clean as it could have been, and that executives had miscalculated on the timing of the changes. Zuckerberg and other Meta executives have been seeking to moderate some of the organizational changes introduced earlier this year without fundamentally changing course. The company laid off 10% of its global workforce and reassigned 7,000 employees to AI-focused teams in May, moves that prompted employee pushback and raised concerns about morale. The changes were part of a broader restructuring aimed at funding costly investments in AI infrastructure and positioning Meta to capitalize on efficiency gains from AI-assisted work, efficiency gains that never arrived, capital investments that never generated any return. That's just me ad-libbing there. Zuckerberg told employees in May that he did not expect further company-wide layoffs this year, though some workers were skeptical. In retrospect, he said the trajectory of the agentic development over the last 4 months hasn't really accelerated in the way that we expected, and the company's bets on the new structure haven't come to fruition yet. Zuckerberg was referring to AI agents, automated systems that can execute tasks on behalf of a user. It's also worth pointing out that this time span he's talking about over the last 4 months, that also coincides with the decline of token maxing due to the sudden change at the major AI frontier labs to go from basically an all-you-can-eat buffet to consumption-based billing. You know, the whole agentic AI thing really took a big hit when that change happened, because AI agents are incredibly compute intensive. And if you have to pay for all of the compute you need, not just a flat monthly fee, the people who have AI agents constantly running in the background are burning through money all this whole time. And well, if they're not actually doing any important tasks, not actually saving any time, then it's just a big waste of money, kind of like I've been saying for years. conversations he was having with our top people when they started planning the restructuring in January and February were that they were worried that they weren't going to move fast enough to adapt, Zuckerberg said. Well, boy, that almost sounds like a fear of missing out, doesn't it? At that time, he said executives were super optimistic about tools like Claude Code from AI startup Anthropic, see earlier discussion about token maxing. Meta is projected to spend as much as $145 billion on AI infrastructure this year, a significant portion of big tech's more than $700 billion outlay on the technology. And that last paragraph, I have to ask, if Meta is saying that they're not seeing the gains from agentic AI, if they're saying that we've already overbuilt our capacity and now we're basically going to be a neocloud, then how can they justify continuing to spend that $145 billion? The simple answer is they can't. They can't. If they're already saying we spent too much and we built too much, stop building more seems like the next logical conclusion, right? Right? I mean, we are talking about big tech here. That being said, the first hyperscaler, the first of those Mag 7 companies to announce a cutback in their CapEx, you better believe the NASDAQ is going to dive 1,000 points the day that happens. Could be soon. Meanwhile, Anthropic is discussing a new custom chip with Samsung. All right, that's interesting. What does it do? Let's read on. Back in April, Reuters reported that Anthropic was toying with the idea of producing its own AI chips as a means of responding to chip shortages. Now it would appear that the company is getting serious about this idea. On Thursday, the information reported that Anthropic was in contact with Samsung to explore a collaboration around the pending chip. However, Anthropic hasn't yet decided what the chip will be used for, how it will fit into the server, or how powerful it would be, according to the report. Okay, so they're going to make a chip, and it's going to do a thing. What thing will it do? We don't know, but we're going to make a chip, and that's the story. When reached for comment, Anthropic told TechCrunch that a diversified hardware stack that includes chips from Google, Amazon, and NVIDIA will continue to be pivotal to its compute strategy. On the topic of a potential Samsung partnership, the company said it had nothing further to add. All right, so maybe we'll make a chip that does a thing. We don't know what that thing is. Seems like a non-story, right? And yet that's enough to send South Korean stocks rocketing. South Korean stocks jumped 6% after turbulent week on AI swings. South Korean stocks rebounded after a near 10% drop in the previous two sessions, highlighting skittish investor sentiment as scrutiny grows over the sustainability of the global AI boom. The Kospi Index gained 5.8% on Friday as Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix both rallied more than 8%. The Korean exchange briefly halted program buying as Kospi futures jumped. They're doing that on like a daily basis now. Foreign funds and retail investors were net sellers of the benchmark stocks while local funds added positions. The market has been whipsawed this week by shifts in AI sentiment as an overstretched rally with the two chip makers tripling this year at their peaks left investors hypersensitive to headlines. The latest catalyst was a report that Anthropic is in talks with Samsung to co-develop a custom chip, which boosted the Korean chip maker's foundry outlook. Expectation is growing over another blowout quarter when it reports preliminary results on Tuesday. All right, so a chip that will do a thing, we don't know what thing, was apparently enough to send South Korean stocks ripping almost 6%. Big green candle up, offsetting the losses from the prior day, or at least most of the losses from the prior day. Again, on basically no story, this volatility in South Korea, it is getting out of hand. The Kospi Index is essentially just two companies right now, SK Hynix and Samsung. That's more than 50% of the index. Talk about concentration risk. Meanwhile, Tesla had its worst day in years yesterday. Tesla stock sinks 7% despite strong deliveries report, posting worst day in nearly a year. I'm sorry, I said years. Year, singular. Tesla reported vehicle deliveries and production levels for the second quarter that far exceeded Wall Street expectations as Elon Musk's automaker tries to rebound from consecutive annual declines in auto sales. Here are the key numbers. Total Q2 vehicle deliveries, 480,126. Total Q2 vehicle production, 451,758. Those are both big beats. Analysts were expecting 406,600 deliveries, beat that by almost 74,000. And the consensus estimate was for, where was the production? Anyway, the production number was also significantly higher than expected. Now, Tesla has a history of doing this, of selling off after reporting better than expected deliveries and production. So that's not such a shock, but there is something that's very surprising buried in this article. And by surprising, I mean not at all surprising, eye-rolling how predictable these people are. Elon Musk's SpaceX, which just went IPO, by the way, and owns XAI, bought $269 million worth of Tesla Megapacks in April, according to its IPO filing. SpaceX is using the Megapacks to reduce XAI's electricity costs at its power-hungry data centers in and around Memphis, Tennessee. You can't make this up. So who's buying Tesla's power packs, their batteries? XAI is, or SpaceX is. So congratulations, if you bought SpaceX, your money is being used to prop up the sales at Tesla, which, by the way, just happens to share a CEO and big shareholder. In the second quarter deliveries report, Tesla did not disclose whether related party transactions contributed to the strong numbers. Last year, SpaceX spent $131 million purchasing Tesla Cybertrucks, the same company that just bought $269 million worth of power packs, just happened to buy one out of every five Cybertrucks that were sold last year. That dollar amount represented a large portion of the 20,237 Cybertrucks Tesla sold in 2025, according to Kelly Blue Book. So SpaceX is inflating Tesla's numbers both for Cybertrucks and now for Megapacks. Look, this round-tripping related party transactions, it's nothing new. I spent the last few years shaking my fist at the universe, pounding it on the table, demanding attention, demanding people acknowledge that this fraud was happening. And everybody's like, don't care. My stocks go up to the moon. Well, Tesla had a bad day yesterday. They lost 7.5% on that report. They gained a little bit back after hours yesterday, but they're trading at $394.40. Meanwhile, the Kurds are getting froggy over in Iran. And look, Iran's been kind of quiet for the last few days, but now we're heading into a long weekend, and everybody knows we have our wars on the weekend now. So who knows? Maybe this one flares up over the weekend. Iran risks new war front as Kurdish attacks rise amid U.S. ceasefire. An uptick in clashes between Iranian security forces and Kurdish rebel groups is threatening to open a new front in the Islamic Republic's conflict with the United States and Israel, testing a fragile ceasefire between Tehran and Washington. As the United States and Iran continue to strive toward a final deal following the historic memorandum of understanding, I could use a lot of words to describe that MOU. I'm not sure historic would be part of it, although it will make history. But, you know, the world's biggest pile of shit would also make history. I'm just saying. It reported on Tuesday on the deaths of two of its members at the IRGC and what was described as by authorities as a terrorist and cowardly act in the city of Pave, located in western province of Kermanshah. The Norway-based Hangal Organization for Human Rights said that the attack was claimed by the newly formed Kurdish group called, Jori Hiwa, or Son of Hope. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. The incidents are part of a string of clashes reported since last week. While Iran has a history of Kurdish insurgency dating back decades to the pre-revolutionary era, the latest unrest follows earlier threats from U.S. and Israeli officials to weaponize Kurdish movements against the Islamic Republic throughout the conflict. Iranian outlets are making the connection, highlighting reports in the New York Times and Israeli media of an alleged Mossad-backed plan to spark a Kurdish offensive that ultimately never materialized. For now, Kurdish forces pose little threat, according to Henry Barkey, former State Department official now serving as senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations. He said that the IRGC finds itself in the driver's seat here after the war, but this could change. The danger Kurds pose is down the road, and in the event that unrest, as we saw earlier in the year, were to spread nationally, forcing the dispersal of internal security forces, then Kurds can liberate selective cities, giving the impetus to the uprising. All right, so the Kurds are getting froggy. More problems for the Iranians to deal with. What will the U.S. do if the Kurds start fighting the Iranians, the IRGC, in large numbers? As all of that is going on, they're talking about a supply glut in oil again. That flipped, that story about oil shortages becoming a glut, man, that flipped real fast. This is from Javier Blas, who's one of the big commodities analysts at Bloomberg. He said, J.P. Morgan, beloved by the oil bulls for its $200 warning in March, is now decidedly bearish. That JP Morgan says a wave of oil is about to enter the market, and here lies the paradox. The surge in oil supply is about to collide with a market that, at least for now, simply does not need it. And how do you digest that? I mean, we're dumping the SPR, millions of barrels, probably like 100 million barrels has been dumped already, about 1.5 million barrels a day the U.S. is dumping. We're exporting a ton of oil. The Chinese were burning through their reserves. Chinese imports dropped by as much as 6 million barrels a day at one point during this conflict. So are we really talking about a market that does not need oil? Is that really? I mean, man, that story changed quick. And I honestly don't know what to believe now. When in doubt, just go with the price signals, right? You got all these stories about shortages, about Cushing is getting low, about reserves being drained, and yet look at the price of oil, $68.61 a barrel. Maybe it's the Treasury is naked shorting futures, manipulating things. I don't know. I mean, hey, look, stranger things have happened, and do we need to get out the tinfoil hat? All right, let's get out the tinfoil hat. Sure, why not? It's the 4th of July. Let's don the tinfoil hat. Maybe it is the U.S. Treasury is naked shorting oil futures. They did it with, you know, we all think they do it with silver, right? Man, well, silver is a lot easier to suppress. It's a much more illiquid market where there's more trading on paper and physical. But the oil market is one of the deepest, most liquid markets in the world. It would be really hard to fake out the oil market because it's just not as paper driven as some of the other commodities are. Not to say impossible, and the U.S. Treasury obviously has very deep pockets. But just that it would be a monumental task. Or just maybe the Strait of Hormuz is not as important as we thought it was. Again, I don't really know who to believe at this point. You've got stories of shortages and excess capacity at the same time. When in doubt, go with the price signal from the market, and the market is saying lower. Meanwhile, we've got commercial real estate. Check out this story. Again, shout out to the Pasta Man who sent me this one and FC Nightingale on Twitter who posted this last night. S2 Capital dissolves $400 million first fund with no return of capital. Yeah, you lost all your money. That's what that means. Founder Scott Everett also asked investors for another $100 million to help transfer viable assets in a new fund. The cojones on this guy, right? Oh, yeah. Sorry. I lost all of your $400 million. Can I have another $100 million? That guy might not get the money. S2 Capital is dissolving its first multifamily fund with no capital returns. The same news recently relayed to investors in the firm's real estate investment trust. A July 1st letter from founder Scott Everett that was shared with The Real Deal said that the $400 million valued add funds, limited partners, and preferred equity investors will receive no return of capital. S2 closed its first fund in September of 2022 after launching earlier that year with a goal of $250 million. It closed its second multifamily fund last summer, raising $373 million. Everett blamed the exceptionally challenging environment for the fund's troubles, citing the rising cost of debt, cap rate growth, and record supply. The fund's 20-property portfolio saw an average 16% increase in expenses and 50% increase in the cost of interest, while the rents dropped an average of 24% across the portfolio, Everett detailed in the letter. Now, this is pretty wild here, guys. They're talking about rents dropped 24% across the portfolio. I don't know if that means the rent they're charging dropped or just people just aren't paying them. Maybe people are delinquent and they're having to evict people because I don't really know of many places across the country. And I think most of these properties are in Texas, by the way. I don't know of many places where the rent has gone down by 24%. So I think that 24% is just people not paying. Either way, oh my God, a 100% loss. No return of capital in this commercial real estate fund. Is negative 100% a lot? Asking for a friend. On to private credit, that other bubble. Blue Owl keeps withdrawal cap as redemption requests remain elevated. Blue Owl is the poster child for the private credit bubble, and things are not really getting better there. They are slightly less catastrophic this morning, but still really bad. Blue Owl Capital maintained a 5% quarterly withdrawal limit for two of its private credit funds as redemption requests remained substantially above the cap, despite falling by a few percentage points in the second quarter. and shareholder letters released on Thursday, the New York-based firm said investors sought to withdraw $4.7 billion from the two funds in the second quarter, compared with $5.4 billion in the prior quarter. All right, so they still want to withdraw a ton of money, but it's not quite as bad as it was last quarter. Shares of the asset manager jumped 6% as the data indicated the redemption pressure was easing. Withdrawal requests at the $4.9 billion technology-focused Blue Owl Technology Income Fund fell to 38.1% in the second quarter, down from 40.7% in the prior quarter. Okay, that's an improvement, right? Only 38% of people want their money back instead of 41. Things are really looking up. That is a dreadful number. And that's why I said only slightly less catastrophic is what these results are. And the fact that a stock would rally on this news is really mind-boggling. Meanwhile, the flagship fund, $33.8 billion Blue Owl Private Credit or Blue Owl Credit Income Corp, or OCIC, that fund saw redemption requests fall to 18.8%. in the quarter, down from 21.9. Again, catastrophic numbers here. 19% want their money back. Oh, but at least it's not the 22% that it was last quarter. These are horrible numbers, and the only saving grace is that they were horribler last quarter. And don't for a second think that the industry is going to follow that trend, because the trend in the industry has been worse, not better. If you take all of these private credit funds in aggregate and you look at the change in redemption requests and the amount of money they're getting back, both numbers are getting worse. This one in the Wall Street Journal from yesterday, investors seek to pull nearly $16 billion from private credit funds. Weary of a prolonged redemption cycle, more fund managers are rationing withdrawals. The giant sucking sound in private credit funds got louder in the second quarter as investors tried to pull more money out and got less back. Investors asked to withdraw $15.6 billion from widely held private credit funds in the second quarter, up from the roughly $13.9 billion they tried to pull from those funds in the prior quarter. Despite the rising requests, fund managers returned $5.9 billion in the second quarter, down from $7.4 billion they agreed to pay out in the prior period. That's according to data from investment bank Robert A. Stanger. The tallies highlight two clear trends. Individual investors have awakened to the fact that they can't exit from the funds called business development companies as quickly as they entered, prompting more of them to start withdrawing. And fund managers are battening down the hatches for a prolonged period of elevated withdrawals. While some big firms like Blackstone opted to honor all redemptions during the first quarter, they have now capped withdrawals at 5% to preserve capital for future investors. So both trends getting worse. Investors want more back, and they're getting less. So even though Blue Owl, who was the poster child for this private credit crisis, maybe things got a little bit better for them, but on the whole industry is getting a lot worse. And that is all we got for you guys today. Guys, I want you to have an awesome long weekend. Happy birthday, America. Happy 4th of July, everybody. Hey, look, things aren't great. Things aren't perfect, but at the end of the day, I'd rather live here than anywhere else in the world. FNA, here's my America mug. Happy birthday. Everybody have fun and be safe. And I just want to say thank you very much, everyone, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Also, shout out to my magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon, YouTube memberships, and Buy Me a Coffee. Today is Friday, and we are going to be doing our 2 o'clock Q&A on Zoom. Links down below to all that good stuff, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.